Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the afternoon session of the City Council for June 24th. Would you please call the roll?
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman? Novick?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Hales?
Here. Welcome, everyone. We're going to get started in a minute with the afternoon calendar. Just want to welcome everyone here to Council Chambers. We're going to have, obviously, quite a few people interested in testifying today, so let me tell you a little bit about how that works. We're going to have some invited testimony at the front of our consideration of these resolutions this afternoon. Then we'll have public testimony, and that's open to anyone that wants to speak. And just let the council clerk know if you're not already on the list, and she'll make sure that you are. Obviously, with the number of people here, we're going to have to limit testimony in time, and so I'm going to ask everyone to try to keep your testimony to 2 minutes so that we can hear everyone. Speaking of hearing everyone, we have some basic rules of courtesy here in the chamber, which is that if you agree with someone and want to somehow indicate that other than a smile, feel free to give them a thumbs up or a wave of the hand. And likewise, if you feel so inclined, if you disagree with someone, do some sort of hand signal as long as it's not obscene. But we ask that people in this chamber not make vocal demonstrations in favor or against their fellow citizens' point of view so that everybody does get heard and feel that they can be. If you're a lobbyist representing an organization under our code, you need to let us know that. If you're representing an organization, you can let us know that as well. If you have handouts that you want the council to receive, please give them to our council clerk, and she'll get them to us and distribute them to us. And you need not give us your address if you're here to speak on one of these items. You just need to give us your name. So that's pretty much it. In terms of rules of procedure, I want to ask our council clerk to read the three items together, and then we'll begin with testimony.
687, adopt the joint City of Portland and Multnomah County 2015 Climate Action Plan to reduce local carbon emissions by 80% from 1990 levels by 2050. 688, direct city bureaus to implement policies and programs to keep Portland on a path to reduce local carbon emissions 80% from 1990 levels by 2050. And 689, establish private sector investor support for city investments in environmentally responsible capital projects, including green bonds and other climate-related financing tools.
Thank you. So as you've heard, we're taking up actually three separate resolutions this afternoon on three different aspects of this huge and growing challenge. One is to adopt our 2015 version of our climate action plan. The second is to tell our city bureaus to move forward with policies and projects and programs to actually implement it and make it real. And the third is establishing our interest in this relatively new idea of green bonds as a way to finance projects, some of them city infrastructure projects that have environmental benefits. Climate change is a huge challenge. As of this week, more than 800 people have died in Pakistan because of the catastrophic heat wave there. There are severe storms worldwide, but including recently in the Midwest. California, Washington are now dealing with spreading wildfires much earlier in the year than has been traditionally the case. And this weekend could be a record-breaking heat weekend for here in Portland. And it's a global challenge that we all believe we have a role in. Next month, I'm going to be very privileged to join a group of 16 other mayors from around the world who've been invited to go to the Vatican and confer with Pope Francis and the Vatican Academy on these issues, because the Catholic Church, among many other organizations, is paying attention to these issues, and the Pope has recently issued a papal encyclical that's really a remarkable articulation of the connection between climate change and justice and the quality of people's lives. If you haven't read it, like me, it may be the first time that you've read a papal encyclical, but I recommend it. It's an amazing document. Climate change is not a new challenge. For more than 20 years, Portland has actually had a plan to address climate change, and we're actually seeing real results. Our emissions here in Portland are lower than they were in 1990, despite the fact that we've added more than 170,000 people and 75,000 jobs. So we have proven that even a growing city, even a prosperous city, can make improvements. And I think that's an important message for us to take to that conversation and many others. We're considering a major update to the city-county climate action plan, because this is a joint effort between us and Multnomah County. And again, both governments make commitments in this plan to do things that will make a difference. I'm particularly pleased, and I know others will be, that this new plan elevates equity. A lot of the same things that are reducing carbon emissions are creating Portland as a better place to live and as a place where there's economic opportunity. And that's important because for a long time, not all Portlanders have had access to those community benefits that my favorite economist, Ed Whitelaw, calls the second paycheck, the things that we get as a community because we live here. But again, it's not equally true. Communities of color, low-income people, have not had the same access to frequent transit service or sidewalks in East Portland, something this council's starting to address. They've not always had equal access to energy efficiency programs because often lower income people are renters and therefore they don't have the easy access to financing options to fund retrofits. Same thing with solar. A lot of renters have had no opportunity to really lower their energy costs with solar because that's the landlord's decision. Same thing with recycling information, again, because multifamily residents don't necessarily have the same opportunities as single-family residents do. I'm particularly, again, pleased that this is a partnership with Multnomah County and that Chair Kafuri is here and is going to be our first testifier this afternoon. But I also want to call out my colleagues that every bureau in city government, all five of us, have a role as both legislators here in the city to consider and adopt these kinds of plans, but we also manage bureaus that, again, make these things real in how we operate and how we serve the city. So, again, want to welcome everyone, and I have a number of invited testifiers to call, but first, Multnomah County Chair Deborah Kafuri. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here today, and as I was here last week, unfortunately, I missed the both of you, but I was here last week. I've decided I'm going to be coming every week. I'm sure there's many things on your agenda that I have to talk about.
Always welcome.
Thank you. Deborah Kafuri, Multnomah County Chair. Good afternoon. Every generation faces a challenge that requires us to be bolder and braver than we've been before. And I believe that climate change is our generation's challenge. What we do today to fight climate change will determine the health of the community that our children will inherit tomorrow. But our actions will also send a clear message to communities of color, to the homeless, and to seniors who will be disproportionately affected by climate change, that we are committed to making our community more equitable. Over the past couple of days, I've been working with our Office of Emergency Management to prepare for this second heat wave of the year. And let's remember that summer has just begun. Science tells us that we are going to have more extreme weather in the future, and our climate is changing faster than any of us could have imagined. 13 of the last 15 hottest years on record have occurred since 2000, and 2015 is already on track to become the hottest year on record. In light of these challenges, our work together on the Climate Action Plan is more important than ever, and our city-county partnership is more important than ever. Climate change is a global issue, but the impacts of climate change hit hardest at the local level. Your Multnomah County Health Department has studied how global warming will affect our health, and no surprise, it's bad news. First, we're going to have more heat waves. Because Portland's weather is usually so mild, many residents live without air conditioning, like me, and I'm sure many in this room. Residents with medical problems or those who live alone or on our streets will feel the full brunt of these changing weather patterns. Second, heat makes our existing air quality issues even worse. When it comes to the nation's worst diesel pollution, Oregon ranks sixth. And among counties, Multnomah County is the fourth worst. We are worse than Los Angeles. And we find concentrations of diesel emissions 2 to 3 times higher where people of color live. As our climate changes, if you have asthma or emphysema, you will find it more difficult to breathe. And finally, warmer winters with more intense rainstorms will lengthen the mosquito breeding season and cause new species of mosquitoes to move in. It's not just a matter of livability. Mosquitoes can carry deadly diseases like the West Nile virus, which we are already starting to see in Oregon. As the Pope has said, the elderly, the homeless, and the communities of color will be most impacted by climate change. They may live in substandard housing conditions that already have mold and mildew. They can be older adults who are socially isolated. They may have limited access to healthy places like parks and green spaces or lack the means to get out of town when the weather gets hot. Addressing these disparities and making our community climate resilient is a vital part of doing our job. That means reducing greenhouse gas emissions, preparing for the impacts of climate change, and ensuring that in the process we make our community more fair. And I am heartened to see that our efforts are resulting in real change. Carbon emissions are down 14% from 1990, as you said, Mayor, while our population and our workforce has grown, which shows that we can decrease emissions and grow our economy. Today, we are challenged to go even further, and our 2015 Climate Action Plan does just that, accelerating our efforts to reduce carbon emissions while targeting our work so that helping those who will be most impacted is at the center of our mission. Thank you for your ongoing partnership and your dedication to this work.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Questions for our chair? Thank you, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you. So let me now call on a panel of folks to talk about the resolutions before us. Susan Anderson from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, as well as Michael Armstrong from the Bureau, and then Catherine Hayhoe from the Texas Tech Climate Science Center, who's here in Portland fortuitously this week, and we're very happy to have you here. And Jonas Beery, our debt manager, will come up and bring a chair with him, I think. So. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Just going to kick it off.
Mayor, Commissioner Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. So I was thinking about developing remarks for this and realized that just over 20 years ago, Mike Lindbergh and I had worked developing the first climate action plan. We did it in a room that was flipped around at that time. You all were, not you all, but others in your positions were back there, and we had this long, dark, dusty sort of city hall, and we presented at that time. At that time, it was the first local action plan on climate change. And at that time also, I can remember working on this issue, talking about this issue to the bureaus, to residents, to businesses, and so many people still believe that, was this for real? We didn't understand it as climate change. We still called it global warming. But times have really changed since that time. Then global warming was absolutely an environmental issue. It was like air pollution or water pollution. Now we know that working on climate change is just as much an economic development issue and a financial strategy for our community, just as much as an environmental strategy. And we have hundreds of companies in Portland that produce or provide services around technologies, different products, all related to sustainability, to reducing the use of fossil fuels. In addition, our local companies, our residents, and our city government have benefited from 20 years of energy efficiency programs that the state's nonprofits, the Energy Trust of Oregon, and other organizations, including the city, have helped to bring together, literally saving billions of dollars. So this is one of those things where a penny saved is more than a penny earned. These dollars are dollars that are not going out of the community but are being recirculated within the community for weatherization, for energy efficiency improvements, all things that are very labor intensive. In fact, we've saved more than $60 million within Portland city government over the past 20 years. Also 20 years ago, we hoped that national governments around the globe would latch on to this issue. But as the years went by, we realized very clearly that cities would not only have to be part of the answer, but that indeed they were the primary place where most of the action is happening. And now we know that cities is really where it's at in terms of action on climate change. Around the world, cities are in the leadership position, and we know that we can't wait for the national governments to come to some kind of worldwide accord at the Conference of Parties. Absolutely, that work has to go on, but we need to take action now. The proof is in the numbers. As the mayor and Commissioner Cafori have mentioned, our greenhouse gases have fallen dramatically by more than 30% per person here in Portland, while for the rest of the world, really, in most other cities, the emissions are going in the other direction. And because of this, we're recognized for our accomplishments by different federal agencies, by nonprofits, by foundations, and most recently, as the mayor mentioned, by the Vatican. As you all know now, Mayor Hales will meet with the Pope and 15 other international mayors in July to discuss opportunities for cities to make a difference. Pope Francis, in his encyclical, again, weird that we're all reading encyclicals now, but it's great reading, recommend it to anyone. He has brought our, in my mind, our head and our hearts together on this issue, which is essential. He's brought together the issues of social justice and climate change together. So in the spirit of understanding that this issue is an environmental issue, but it is very much about people, about their jobs, about their livelihood, about their homes, about how they get to work, all of those things together. We've asked a very special guest who happened to be in town today. I think sometimes we think these things are magic or something, but this was meant to be. Dr. Catherine Hayo is an atmospheric scientist from Texas Tech University. She's the director of the Climate Science Center. She's absolutely a leading scientist and a data cruncher, but moreover, she's a person of deep moral conviction. I read something on her website that it just kind of smacked me in the face in terms of, it said more or less, we have three choices. We can mitigate, we can adapt, or we can suffer. And we're likely going to do all three of those things. And it's really a question of what's the mix going to be. Dr. Hayo is in town for a lecture with the World Affairs Council. She will briefly provide her perspective on climate change and hopefully a little bit about Portland's role in making a difference in our little corner of the world. So thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Well, my name is Catherine Hayo, for the record, and I am a climate scientist at Texas Tech University. I love cities. I work with cities all across America. Blue, red, green, and every color in between, big and small, to help cities prepare for a changing climate. Because the future is in cities. That is where most of us live, and that is where most of us experience the impacts of a changing climate. But at the same time, my work as a scientist is very clear. For almost 15 years now, I've been studying the difference that our choices make in terms of the future that we're going to be facing. And it is crystal clear that if we continue on our current pathway, and I don't mean Portland's pathway, I mean the world's pathway, if we continue on our current pathway of depending on fossil fuels to supply our primary source of energy, we are going to end up with changes that we cannot prepare for, changes that will be dangerous from an economic perspective, from a health perspective, and from a well-being of life perspective. And so that's why I'm so excited about what Portland is doing. It really is an example. One of the biggest arguments people have is, well, you know, we could do everything we could, but, you know, if China's not doing anything or India's not doing anything, why should it matter? But that's a myth. They are doing things. China's a world leader in wind and solar energy. And cities are one of the main ways that that idea that we can reduce our emissions and prosper economically, that that idea is spreading around the world. As a scientist, I know what science can do for us. Science can tell us that climate is changing. Science can tell us that for the first time in human history, we have crawled into the driver's seat of our planet and elbowed natural causes out of the way, and we have taken control of our planet's climate. We're the ones doing what's happening today. Science can also tell us that depending on the choices we make, we're going to see very different outcomes. But science stops there. And so that's why it's so important to connect this issue to our values. And for over 80% of Americans, many of our values come from our faith. So the Pope's encyclical is essential because it speaks to values. Why do we care about climate change, and what should we do about it? As one of my colleagues said, science is like a compass. It can tell us which way is north, south, east, and west. But science can't tell us which way to go, because that depends on our values. So I welcome this discussion of connecting our action in terms of not just preparing for climate change, but reducing the impact we're having on our planet, as you are today, to what is it that we really care about? What is important to us? What is in our hearts? Because only, as Jane Goodall said, working with our clever brain and our human hearts together, can we accomplish what we need to. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much for being here today. Thank you. Michael.
So thank you, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm Michael Armstrong with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. I know, Dr. Hayo, the World Affairs Council has many things in store for you this afternoon, so I think if you need to...
I'll listen to you and then we'll...
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to go on and on and on and on.
Oh, you are. In that
case. I think you can do it in 8 minutes.
No, he's not.
I'll be cut off before then.
You've been warned.
I duly noted. I will then offer an overview of the plan and kind of highlight some of the key actions in it that are different than previous versions, and then certainly we'll take your questions. And I know there are people who are here to testify as well.
I do have to go. I got the nod.
I thought so.
I'm not leaving because this isn't important. It's really important.
Look forward to your speech
tonight.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. Let's suspend the rules and welcome her to Portland. Thank you.
Thank you all. So, as Susan noted, Portland's been working on climate change now for more than two decades. I sometimes bring around the 5 1/4 inch floppy diskettes that have the data on them from the original 1993 Climate Action Plan. And it is, I think it illustrates the sustained commitment that people in your shoes have made, that businesses, individuals have made, and it really is the reason we are currently on a good trajectory. I think it's also the reason we know that after 20 years of hard work, we still have a long way to go. And so I think that's one of the lessons of the work Portland has done to date. This work has led to an impressive list of accomplishments, a number of them on the screen here that for you to see. Energy use per person is significantly lower than it was in 1990. We're using quite a bit less gasoline than we were in 1990. You can see the commuting figures, one of the highest recycling rates in the country. Transit ridership has doubled since 1990. We are starting to see impressive growth in the number of electric vehicles. The list goes on. Installations of photovoltaic systems, green building, eco-roofs, invasive plants, planting trees and shrubs. And Susan referenced the energy savings in the city's own operations as a result of this sustained commitment to reducing energy use, switching to renewable energy. You put all those things together, and the trend is encouraging. So the bottom line here, the blue line, is for Multnomah County, for across the whole community, and you can see that the trend really has departed from the national picture. It's also encouraging that the national picture has started to bend down as well. We need to have other people follow in our footsteps and the footsteps of a number of other leading cities now. So this is encouraging. At the same time, the pairing of declining emissions with population growth, with economic growth, is really, really important. And when the conversation goes to China and India, this is the kind of graph that is really useful to them to see that this is possible. This is what they are trying to do as well. So it's an important lesson that I think we have experienced in Portland and we can share elsewhere. We're also mindful we really have a long way to go. The city's goal for a number of years now has been to reduce emissions 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. We're 14% below. We're making real progress, and there's a lot of work ahead of us. And that's why we update this climate plan periodically. Let's establish the next set of actions for the city and county to take on. Let's respond to emerging opportunities, changing technologies, new partners. Let's work with the community to do that. So the 2015 plan came about through a process that involved a steering committee. We'll hear from a couple members of that in a few minutes. We had an equity working group. One of the real differences in this plan from previous versions was the intention to address equity and elevate it as a priority as we're reducing carbon, as we're preparing for climate changes. We need to do that in ways that are attentive to people who have not always had the opportunities and, in fact, have often been more burdened by those activities. And so we made a real effort to address that through developing the plan. Certainly a lot of staff work has gone into this from bureaus really across the city, departments across the county, and then in some cases bringing together more technical advisory groups to give us good insight into specific issues. We have a lot of plans, and so as we update the Climate Action Plan, you know, the previous plan was in 2009. Since then, the city's adopted its first climate change preparation strategy. We also had the Portland Plan in 2012, and now we've got a proposed draft of the comprehensive plan. So the earlier climate plans provided input into those plans. Those plans, in turn, evolve policy and ideas further. They give us input into the new climate plan. We're obviously bringing other ideas as well, and so it's an iterative process. With the emphasis on equity and bringing in, I think, our longer-standing recognition of the economic opportunities in climate action, we really do want this climate plan to be helping deliver on our commitments to being healthy, prosperous, resilient, and equitable. And so that's a real priority as we've gone through each of these individual actions. The plan's organized into these eight areas, and these are actually very similar to the areas in the 2009 plan. Framework is staying largely the same, but we're updating all of the actions, and we're often providing more specificity about how we intend to carry out those actions. So I'll go very quickly through each of these just to illustrate some of the major actions in each arena. If you look at Portland's carbon footprint from a kind of conventional way of measuring, about 40% of it comes from energy use in buildings and electricity supply. And so the priority actions that we've identified here, energy performance reporting. Earlier this spring, you all acted on a policy for commercial energy benchmarking. There are similar opportunities around energy use in homes, and so we'd like to work with our community partners to really elevate home energy use as something people should be attentive to when buying or renting a home. We also want new opportunities for community solar. Mayor, you referenced the challenges with that up to now, so that's a priority, making solar more broadly available. At a state level, this plan identifies a carbon price, whether it's a carbon tax or cap on trade, as a priority policy for the state. It also suggests that the city should look at doing that locally if it doesn't come through at the state. As Susan suggested, we've waited a long time for federal action. We feel some urgency to move forward where we can. New construction, we're now in the midst of another building boom, so new construction is a big opportunity to really optimize energy performance at the time buildings are constructed. So there are actions in there to accelerate that. And then the climate plan calls for council to adopt a policy around fossil fuel exports. And this is something there's been a lot of conversation about over the course of the spring, and I think you'll hear testimony about today. And so the current action calls to initiate that development process. So 40% of emissions from buildings and energy, another 40% from transportation. A lot of the transportation emissions are driven by what your urban form is to start with, and then what kind of transportation system you have to offer to people. Key to this, certainly from a carbon perspective, but from an almost everything perspective, stable long-term funding. This is not a new issue, but it's a very, very important one for our carbon goals as well as for many other things. The fundamental building block here really is healthy, connected neighborhoods. We need these walkable neighborhoods. We need compact urban form. We need to connect them with efficient, convenient, affordable transportation options. We also need to be moving toward lower carbon fuels, so biofuels, electric vehicles, compressed natural gas, especially for larger vehicles. So we want to be moving forward on all three of these fronts. One of the other new issues that the climate plan really elevates is consumption. And so for the first time, we have continued to measure emissions in a conventional way, add up the energy use, look at what waste that goes to landfill. We've also analyzed all of the goods and services that are consumed by households and businesses and government agencies in Portland. And so we have a new way of understanding the magnitude of our consumption footprint in addition to the things that actually take place here. And that it really initiates a conversation around what's the city's role in informing household and business decisions about consumption. And so it calls for us to develop a strategy around this rather than leaping to we know exactly what we need to do. But it turns out that the consumption footprint is maybe unsurprisingly much, much larger than the energy that's actually used here. We are net consumers of all kinds of things, and we should look at that as an opportunity to reduce emissions as well. We're good recyclers. We're good composters. We need to make the same opportunities available in multifamily properties, and so that's a new focus in this climate plan. And then making better use of goods while they're still usable, so repair, reuse, sharing, lending, lots of opportunities there. Those really affect our consumption footprint. Food and agriculture, the big message here is that what we eat matters, and you know, little chart showing the relative carbon emissions per calorie, and although the letters are small to see the descriptions, you get a sense of the range of impacts. That big long bar at the bottom, so very carbon intensive, is beef. The one at the top is legumes, so you know, beans and right next to it is wheat. So you get this very big range of emissions associated with food choice. We also know that urban agriculture produces a lot of other community benefits. And if you look at what people typically grow in their community garden, in their backyard, they're growing things that are at the very low carbon footprint end of that spectrum. And so there's actually really nice alignment between our urban agriculture work and low carbon emissions. We do want people to understand that food choice matters, and so we'll try to advance that from an information perspective while continuing to create opportunities for everyone to have access to fresh, healthy food, because those tend to be lower carbon foods as well.
Michael?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about the significance of transportation of food compared to production of food in terms of carbon intensity? Because I think that a lot of us used to assume that if you buy local food, then that's always better than buying food from far away. And actually, my understanding is that the type of food matters more.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So, you know, as an average across all the different foodstuffs that people consume, something on the order of 10% of the total emissions are associated with moving that food around. And I think it's 85% are from the production of it, and the balance from kind of retail and wholesale sales. So only about 10% of the emissions are associated with transportation. And so local food is really important for a lot of reasons. If carbon emissions is what you're optimizing for, it's a consideration, but it's only at 10% of that consideration.
But presumably, if you're buying a gallon of milk, buying a gallon of local milk versus some that's trucked from Ohio is the better choice.
Absolutely. That's exactly right.
But eating lentils that come from Chile is probably better than eating beef that comes from next door.
Got it.
He said it.
Probably also true, yes. Yeah. Okay, urban forest and natural systems. I mentioned that last year city adopted a climate change preparation strategy. Important pieces of that have to do with strengthening our natural systems. So they help us be more resilient as the climate changes. They also often help to sequester carbon. So they're taking carbon out of the atmosphere. They're helping slow climate change as well as preparing us for it. And so this helps bring those things together. So very important actions around tree canopy, watershed restoration, removing pavement. These things really help us on both fronts. Chair Kafuri touched on a couple of the major impacts from climate change, the changes that we're seeing. And so this plan brings in the key pieces from the climate preparation strategy. We want to be clear that these are integrated. And so hotter, drier summers, warmer winters with more intense rain events. The heat wave coming this weekend is a perfect illustration of what we need to be prepared for. And so there are significant changes that we need to make in our public health system. We've got wildfire risk this summer that's hopefully not as bad as it's starting to look, but we shall see. And then certainly in the winter, you know, we already have issues managing our rainfall, and we'll probably need to strengthen those systems so that we're doing more of that, because we're likely to get more intense rain events in the winters. Part of the work to elevate equity in this is around community engagement. This really needs to start from the community and not just appear in a plan first. And, you know, we've needed to go back kind of to the start over and really try to approach community groups and work with them on their terms. And so this has been a learning process certainly for me and for many of my colleagues. I feel like we've made some good progress, and I think you'll hear from some of those groups today. We have a long way to go, and we're certainly not going to get to the long-term goals if we're not successful in enabling and supporting community activities. And so a lot of this has to do with responding to community priorities and projects that deliver other benefits. They also often can reduce carbon emissions, and that's a good opportunity for all of us. I think it's a useful point of information when we're interacting with the community on this that, you know, you look back at some of the work that the Oregon Values and Beliefs Project did. The question here was, statement A, climate change requires us to change our way of life, such as driving less or living more simply. You know, 88% of Portland respondents agreed with that statement. It's a very, very big number. And so it doesn't say people are excited about that, but it says they recognize that those kinds of changes aren't needed. So I think the community is receptive to the need to do some of these things. And, you know, as Susan was pointing out, many of them have very, very positive community benefits, either in terms of affordability, in terms of quality of life. So the last section of the plan addresses government operations, so city operations and county operations. Because you all run bureaus, you're familiar with many of these efforts. We're constantly working on improving the performance of our buildings, pump stations, wastewater treatment plant, the LED streetlight replacement project, converting the fleet to electric vehicles, to low-emission vehicles where we have opportunities, So a very long list. You know, the Portland building reconstruction is coming up as a very big opportunity for the city to deliver this in its own operations. One of the tools that we've identified as one way to finance some of those improvements is green bonds. And so this is the subject of the third resolution. And so I want to take just a minute to give Jonas Beery a chance to explain that in detail, because this is a new concept for the city. And I think we're among the early adopters on this. And so I'll let Jonas talk through a couple of slides, and then I will wrap up and we'll take questions.
Great. Thank you. Jonas.
Great. Thanks, Michael. For the record, Jonas Beery, the city's debt manager. As Michael said, green bonds are a fairly new concept, gaining momentum in the municipal marketplace very quickly, kind of a 101, maybe even a step earlier than 101. But the concept is basically we take traditional borrowings that the city would do and add a green bond designation to that. What that does is identifies the bonds, which are investments that the public can invest in, institutional investors can invest in, and retail investors. So those that are interested in investing in green infrastructure that the city's conducting have an opportunity to do that. In theory, because we're matching to that specific interest, there's potential for the city to get better pricing, meaning a lower cost of borrowing. Important to note, the second bullet here, that the market's growing. It's evolving, but certainly currently under development, and want to be upfront in saying that right now the financial benefit is unproven. The market dynamics exist, but I've, for example, talked to investors who said, yes, I really like green bonds, and no, I'm not going to pay you anything different. Now, what we want to do is position ourselves so that we can, in fact, get that financial benefit as well as some of the other benefits. Note here that the requirements are still undeveloped, and so that's important as we develop our strategy, that we're sensitive to adapting to those evolving requirements and expectations. Third bullet, it does not require any changes to the current debt policy, any changes to current financial policy. All existing bond-related documents, covenants, regulatory frameworks would still apply. This is just an added kind of bonus designation. Importantly, we have no city capital projects within the next 6 to 12 months that are expecting long-term financing, and that's important because it gives us the opportunity to be patient and strategic as we develop our plan. To give a sense of the market, I said it's growing rapidly. What you see here is the blue line is global issuance. So 2007, the first issuance by the World Bank, really the entity that developed this concept. You see sort of some World Bank issuances with a smattering of corporate and international. And then really 2013 is when the market started taking off globally. You start to see the red line is U.S. municipal issuance. So 2013, it was pretty much the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. 2014, you see some growth in that red line, State of California, D.C. Water, City of Spokane. 2015, we've already seen throughout the first half of the year increased volume, San Francisco's public utility, New York City, City of Tacoma. So we're starting to see this develop. And as more issuance comes to market, we start to see more refinement of preferences. So I want to focus here mostly on the benefits. Benefits are by issuing green bonds, we express support for taking innovative approaches to financing environmentally responsible projects. It continues to present the leader as a city as a leader in environmental best practices and financial best practices, being on top of financial tools that develop and doing them in the right way. As I noted, it's accommodated within the current financial structure, and we hope to have future reduction in borrowing costs. I note on here a few minor risks, and these are mostly related to potential increases in cost or in administrative requirements of issuing green bonds. And our proposal, or what we envision, is developing a framework that kind of operates in the background that will identify projects in a specific way that will mitigate those risks as we go forward. So, for example, we want to have projects that have clearly reportable outcomes. We want to make sure that they're projects that we aren't going to fund them, and then they change their scope during the course of the financing. So moving on to the proposed resolution, what does it do? This is the third resolution in front of you. It advances the city leadership in sustainable innovation and identifies support for the concept of green bond issuance. It provides three specific directives to city staff to start looking at potential candidates for green bonds, to continue on our end in public finance and treasury to assess the financial cost benefit, including doing further due diligence with market participants, and then to develop standards and procedures for identifying projects and ongoing reporting. So what we'll do going forward is direct a framework, and I say a strong framework because we want to, I've used the analogy, we want to have a top shelf framework, like we have top shelf financial policies, top shelf green objectives, so that we can attract that investor interest that's actually going to give us the incremental benefit. As we do this, it's going to be critical that we involve the infrastructure bureaus as we're starting to develop this framework, water, sewer, transportation, facilities, the entities that are likely to have projects that will fit within the category. And I also think it's critical that we remain flexible as we develop the framework to be nimble and adapt as the market continues to mature. Quickly, what does it not do? It doesn't authorize any specific borrowing. Borrowings will still come to council during the normal authorization request process. It doesn't change city policy, and it's not anticipated to accelerate or adjust project timing schedules, but really looking at capital projects that are already in the pipeline, and most importantly, in my opinion, establishes the foundation for us to get the longer-term financial benefit by developing the framework.
Okay. Thank you. Questions,
Jonas, staff. Just one question. Of course, I'm going to support this because Senator Dingfelder lobbied me on it, and I'm not going to disappoint her. But on the question of this marketplace for green bonds, I mean, the vision here is that over time, if we use our purchasing power in effect and other jurisdictions join in, my understanding is that we can expect the market to align so that we get the competitive, similar interest rates and terms that we would get with conventional financing. So it'll be one of those circumstances where there's no premium, but we get the additional environmental dividend. Is that?
Yeah, that's correct. The market right now, there is evidence that there is no additional cost. I mean, you're not paying a higher cost of borrowing for green issues than you would for a non-green identical issue.
So what we're essentially doing is tapping into a socially responsible investor pool that over time we hope as the market grows, it essentially is at parity with conventional financing. So we're just substituting one set of borrowers for another on competitive terms.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, ideally, we always look to, in our department, expand our investor base. As we get more people coming in and bidding on our bonds, we get a marketplace that has potential to give us better pricing. So assuming the green bond investor marketplace develops, we have potentially more investors interested in participating there, potential for greater pricing. And I would flag, just to think about the market for a second, the slide I had earlier that showed kind of little thin green, red line, $2.6 billion of issuance in 2014 amongst U.S. muni issuers. That represents less than 1% of the total volume of outstanding muni bonds. So you can see that, I mean, as we sort of look around the room here, there's likely more interest in investment in these than there really is product that's out there in the market. So the dynamics are there. They just haven't borne themselves out yet in a demonstrable way.
Susan, I have a question for you. We've got these very bold 2013 objectives. We've got five-year priorities. You got a lot of bureaus, and we're trying to sync them up and get everyone behind the plan. What combination of carrots and sticks do you anticipate to get all the bureaus to play over the next 5 years? And then how can we gauge progress annually, collectively?
So fortunately, most of the bureaus are already doing a fantastic job in most of these areas. We meet regularly once a month with all the bureaus, and we meet once or twice a month with the planning and development bureaus. And this is and could be more of a regular item on the agenda. So the plan is to meet when this is adopted, although we often meet on these regularly anyways. We can come back with an annual report on actions that each of the bureaus have taken to meet the various, and we can broaden that to sustainability broadly if you'd like, or we can keep it to the climate change. In the past, we've done more of a sustainability report.
So I would urge us to think about that as an annual work session to sort of gauge where we are. And also, I think it's, Susan and I have already had this conversation, but I think it's great that she's meeting with the bureau leadership. I think the additional overlay is that each of us sets expectations annually for our bureau directors, and they're either done formally or informally. And so that's another way we can be very prescriptive about where we want the energy, so to speak, focus. So let's think about that as well.
Other questions, comments for staff?
Michael, I know that we're doing better than most other places over the last 20 years in terms of reducing our carbon intensity. Are there cities that do better than we do in terms of carbon emissions per capita? For example, how do we compare to New York City on carbon emissions per capita?
Yeah, there are certainly cities that do a lot better in terms of emissions per capita. It's a fairly complex set of inputs that have to do with everything from the climate, how cold is it in the winter, how hot is it in the summer, to density, where closer people living closer together, multifamily buildings, much more efficient, much better transportation options. So and then the third big piece is what's your electricity come from? It's hydro, renewables. You're going to have a lot smaller carbon footprint. So New York, for example, I believe the numbers. So Portland has a carbon emissions per person of about 10 metric tons. So 10 tons per person. New York's is, I think, around 5.8, maybe 6. So significantly smaller than ours. Mm-hmm. They have much colder winters. They also have much more compact footprint. Their transportation system is amazing, as we all know. Vancouver, BC, emissions per person on the order of, I think, 4.5 metric tons. Their electricity is essentially 100% hydro, and so that takes a big bite off. They've done a pretty good job with their transportation systems, urban form as well. You certainly get, you go to Denver, you go to Minneapolis, you get emissions quite a bit higher than Portland's. So absolute numbers are, I think, useful for what can be accomplished. The trend over time, obviously we all are where we are, so what are our biggest opportunities? We are seeing other kind of cities moving aggressively on this and really driving emissions down. Boston, San Francisco, Philadelphia, New York, Vancouver, Seattle, all have emissions that are now lower than, because they're starting in different places, but they've all declined over the last 5 years ahead of the national trend. That's really encouraging. We all have a long way to go.
On page 76 of the plan, you have a little discussion, compact urban form reduces carbon. Where, for example, you say by encouraging development of new housing units in focused geographic areas like centers rather than spread across the city, grocery stores, restaurants, public spaces, and other services can successfully operate within walking distance of local residents. I think that you also say at some point that transit is more viable in places where there's sort of more people per stop. I mean, is it fair to say that in New York, they have lower emissions in part because everybody rides the subway, but the subway only makes economic sense because there are a lot of people per stop, because there's a lot more people living in apartment buildings, basically.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you very much. I'm sure we may have more questions for you after the hearing, but thank you. Now I want to call a panel of citizens who worked on this plan, who were on a steering committee, Douglas Soy, Kent Snyder, and Duncan Huang. Come on up, please. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What else? You want to go first?
I think I'm going to go first. I think the first thing I would say is everyone in this room would agree that we don't want to be worse than LA in anything, particularly air quality. So my name is Douglas Soy, and along with Kent here, I co-chaired the Climate Action Plan Steering Committee. I also serve on the county's advisory committee on sustainability and innovation. If you look on page 6 of the Climate Action Plan, you'll see the roster of the steering committee. And I got to say, it was a privilege to work with those members and with the BPS staff. We met several times over the last 2 years when the plan came together to provide big picture guidance to the staff. We reviewed the key issues from public comment and helped the staff reconcile the conflicting and competing comments. The Climate Action Plan, this version, has the same goals and framework as the city and county's 2009 plan, but it makes major changes articulating the importance of people in climate work. It's about reducing carbon and preparing for climate impacts, but it's now a lot clearer that we do this because of people, both locally and elsewhere. I think it's just really important to think that we're not doing this for nature, we're really doing this for the people. We'll hear from Duncan Huang about the process the Equity Working Group went through later in this little session here. But I want to call the Council's attention to a couple things. First of all, I think this is a major step up, this plan, because it's a plan. There's tasks. There are people responsible for those tasks. There are priorities based on carbon impacts, co-benefits, equity issues. So compared to the 2009 plan, there's actual concrete things to do. The other thing I would think to focus you on is that we're talking a lot about adaptation now. We're really trying to prepare particularly the most vulnerable for climate impacts. I think a lot about Wayne Gretzky. He had this great quote. He said, "I don't want to skate to where the puck is. I want to skate to where the puck's going to be." I think about this plan, and that's what it is. We're skating to where climate preparation, climate adaptation is going to be. Right? So I think about what future Portland residents are going to think about. I think they're going to be really thankful for the work that we did today.
Thank you. Kent, welcome.
Good afternoon. This, Kent Snyder. I'm also been with Douglas co-chairing this steering committee, and I've actually been around this not as long as Susan has been. I served on the steering committee for the 2009 Climate Action Plan. We spent several years putting that together. I used to chair the Sustainable Development Commission, or co-chair the Sustainable Development Commission for the city and the city county. Was chairing the county's advisory committee on sustainable innovation. So I've been through a lot of the iterations of these things. And a couple things that I actually, really to Commissioner Fish, you had the question you asked to Susan Anderson was the thing that I've noticed, a couple things in the last, over the iterations of these plans, where we started a number of years ago, 10 years ago, where we were really kind of asking bureaus and having to pull a little bit from bureaus and departments to, you know, what are you going to do about this? How is this going to impact your thing? The shift that has happened really is they are engaged. They are forthcoming with great ideas. They have embodied the goals into their operations. I mean, from a citizen's view, both at the city level and the county level. So it's been a really big shift that way. The second thing is I've watched as Susan also referenced, the size of the audience and the diversity of the audience and the conversation. And we went from where it really was a global warming plan. It was an environmental issue to the Sustainable Development Commission said this is the economic strategy really that should rise above all other things for the city and the county, and it has become that. So then the diversity, the people who are involved, this time to really bring in equity, to engage them in a very real constructive way and look at the impacts. And how do we both address those, but also how do we help them economically at the same time, provide those economic opportunities that have been not as readily available to them in the past? So I think we've made a lot of good progress. There's a lot more to be done, but we've got a great framework here. And I guess the steering committee, is going to urge that you adopt the plan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Duncan Huang, Associate Director at the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you also for providing space for our volunteers earlier this morning to speak about, you know, equity issues. I'd really like to start by, you know, speaking about the process for a climate action plan update. Overall, this process of incorporating equity into the update was a really big step forward. A number of community-based organizations received small grants to participate in this year-long process. That was important because we met weekly, basically, for 2 hours at a time to really dive into the details. For our organization, we used our small grant to bring on an intern. She was the president of a Vietnamese Student Association at Portland State University. And this was actually a really empowering experience for her. You know, over the course of the CAP equity process, she really felt like she had her voice heard, and also, you know, really felt empowered by being able to interface with our county and city government. So that was just a great kind of win for, you know, building our capacity long term, and also working with the city and county and kind of building their analysis. So, you know, both sides had a lot of learning to do. we also really use this opportunity to build our organizational capacity to work on environmental issues. You know, we now have a program in Opano that is focused specifically on environmental, you know, work and environmental justice. So the participation in the CAP process really was kind of the first point of contact on environmental issues, but we've really grown, you know, beyond that and now are taking it really seriously. You know, I think over the course of this process, our community really started to feel ownership of the climate action plan and the update. And I think that's, you know, a great thing. It's rare for a non-environmental nonprofit to really feel, you know, that level of ownership in a climate action plan. But I think this process really did facilitate that. Building upon our experience with CAP, you know, we're further engaged in environmental justice and environmental resiliency. We're now proud to be working on our own climate resiliency plan in coalition with other communities of color. It's a coalition including Opano and NEA and OPAL, Coalition of Communities of Color, VOES, and a host of other community-based organizations. And we've newly completed a plan outlining a vision for Portland and Multnomah County that will offer policymakers options on how to best move forward with implementing the goals of a climate action plan without further harming communities of color. This additional process that we've undertaken on our own is really valued or rooted in the values of self-determination and equity. So we really hope to continue to engage Visalia County on its implementation in the future. As for the CAP itself, you know, the values that we brought to the table, I feel, really did show up in the language of the action plan update. I don't think anybody in questions its effectiveness. You know, the reduction of 32% in carbon emissions per capita is a remarkable feat. But I think going forward, we're not going to be able to see these continued gains without being inclusive and including everyone that lives in Portland. For myself, I live and work in East Portland, in the J District in particular. Maps show that we live in an urban heat island. We have limited green space. We have almost no tree canopy. DEQ data shows that we have some of the worst air pollution in the whole city due to our proximity between Southeast 82nd and I-205. This leads to a whole bunch of health disparities. For example, our community has a 16% asthma rate. That's twice the county rate, which is 8%. So, you know, this is a very real health impact for our community. And, you know, talking about Wayne Gretzky and where we want to go, demographics are changing. The fastest growing, you know, demographic in Portland is now Pacific Islander, and that's no accident. You know, Pacific Islanders are facing tremendous environmental degradation in their home islands, and they're moving here and California and Hawaii. But, you know, we're seeing a huge influx, and it's because of climate change. So in closing, you know, we're all here to reduce carbon emissions. But for myself, I'd really like to evaluate the CAP based on its implementation. I think, you know, our values are there, but whether this climate action plan works or not for our community will really be in the, you know, found in the implementation and the implementation guide that's going to come out. You know, I see metrics for reducing greenhouse gases, but I don't see those clear equity metrics. So I'd really like to work with the city and county in making sure that, you know, yes, we're going to reduce greenhouse gases, but we're also going to have metrics that really advance equity for our communities as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for your help with this so far. Keep calling on you. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you much. So let me call another panel of volunteers, Angus Duncan, who chairs the Oregon Global Warming Commission, Mike Houck from the Planning and Sustainability Commission, and Chris Smith from the Planning and Sustainability Commission. So, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, members of the City Council. I assume we can go in no particular order.
Go right ahead.
Least exalted to most exalted. So my name is Angus Duncan. I'm president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation. I chair the State of Oregon's Global Warming Commission, and I was privileged to be a member of the stakeholders group that helped assemble and critique of the plan that's in front of you. And I would just begin by saying there is much to admire and to applaud in this plan, and a huge amount of labor by both stakeholders and city staff people that went into that. And that ought to, we all ought to take a sort of brief pause and silently congratulate ourselves and take a heave and then go back to work. This plan continues Portland's leadership in addressing energy and climate issues that actually goes back further than Kent. It goes back further even than Susan. It at least goes back as far as 35 years ago